and thank all of you for coming today. On behalf of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, I'm John McCauley. I'm serving as president this year of the board, and we welcome you. This is a great turnout, and we are certainly glad to see all of you here. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that our membership is open, and if you're not a member of the Senior Statesmen, we certainly welcome you to sign up and help us with our expenses and to support the organization. And we have a series of great programs coming up. Next month, we're going to have Dahlia Lithwick speaking about the Supreme Court, and we're looking forward to that. And today, we welcome our candidates for the 5th District. And we hope to take the focus off the national election for a few minutes here and focus more locally and give us some information. And I believe this is going to be the first in a series of forums for these two candidates. Our moderator today will be Bob Gibson, and Bob is going to give us the ground rules, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to him. So welcome, and it's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to this afternoon's 5th District Congressional Candidate Forum, sponsored by the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. I'm your moderator, Bob Gibson. We have a participatory format for this afternoon's 90-minute forum, which marks the first time this year that these two candidates for Congress have faced off to discuss issues together. I brought half a dozen questions myself, fearing that there might not be enough people in the room to ask 90 minutes worth of questions. Silly me. You, the audience, are encouraged to participate by posing questions in written form for the candidates. We also ask that you respectfully refrain from applause or any other demonstrations of affection or displeasure during the forum, except when the two candidates are introduced and when we conclude the forum. We'd like to welcome all of you here to the Senior Center in Charlottesville and to thank the Senior Center for hosting the forum. There will be another forum for the candidates in Greene County, sponsored by the League of Women Voters, on October 18th, William Monroe High School. A warm welcome is now due for our two candidates for Congress in the 5th Congressional District, Democratic Party nominee Jane Dittmar of Albemarle County. And Republican Party nominee Tom Garrett of Buckingham County. Democrat Jane Dittmar is the past chair of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors and former supervisor from the Scottsville Magisterial District. She served on the governor's Broadband Advisory Council. Jane Dittmar is a certified mediator for both the General District and Circuit Courts and has served as court coordinator for the General District, Juvenile and Domestic Relations, and Circuit Courts for the City of Charlottesville and the counties of Albemarle, Fluvanna, Greene, and Louisa. She attended the Arlington County Public Schools after her family moved here from rural Illinois. And she graduated from the University of Virginia, where she received a degree in economics. Since then, she's attended the UVA Darden School's Executive Program and the Virginia Tech Center for Public Administration and Public Policy. And over the past 40 years, she has lived and run and worked at businesses in Nelson, Fluvanna, Albemarle, and the city of Charlottesville. Republican Tom Garrett lives in Buckingham County, just south of Scottsville, and is in his second term as state senator, representing the 22nd senatorial district in Virginia. The state senate district is quite large and consists of all or portions of the counties of Amherst, Appomattox, Buckingham, Cumberland, Fluvanna, Goochland, Louisa, Prince Edward, and part of the city of Lynchburg. Tom is a graduate of Louisa County High School and earned both a bachelor's and law degree from the University of Richmond, served 6 years in the Army, worked as assistant attorney general under Bob McDonnell when Bob McDonnell was attorney general. In 2007, he challenged and defeated two-term incumbent for the office of Commonwealth's attorney for Congress in Louisa County and won that office. Then he won a five-way race for the 5th District nomination for Congress. No, for the 22nd senatorial district, and won the 22nd senatorial district over a Lynchburg Democrat who outspent him about 2-1. Our ground rules are simple this afternoon. We are going to have 3-minute opening and 3-minute closing statements from each of the candidates. We had a coin toss prior to the forum, and Jane Dittmar won the toss and will speak first. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to answer questions from the audience, which I will pose from the cards that have been passed up. We have enough cards to keep going for about 5 hours, but we will go into closing statements just before 3 o'clock this afternoon. So I'd like to begin with our first candidate, Jane Dittmar.
Thank you, Bob. I wanted to tell everyone how pleased I am to see you here today. I've been truly looking forward to this. It's the first opportunity we have for a compare and contrast. It's also an opportunity for us, as Bob said, to forget about the national race just for the next hour and concentrate on what the 5th District needs and the kind of person you would like to send to Washington. I would like to be your representative in Washington, and I would like to be the first woman congresswoman from this area. Background and experiences do count. Bob read a bit of a resume for me, but there are a number of you who I know, and then a lot of faces I didn't know when you came in. So I want to tell you why some of the experiences I've had in my life are relevant to you as you decide who to send to Washington. First, Bob mentioned that I come from farm country, Illinois, rural American roots. I was brought as a little girl to Northern Virginia, where I was educated and eventually was blessed to be brought into the University of Virginia as one of the first classes of women. I learned the scientific background as far as what makes an economy hum when I took my degree in economics. And then I learned the practical side of how an economy hums when I started and managed a series of successful small businesses. At a certain point, I was asked by our business community, we had about 1,200 businesses active in the region, to lead them as their president, and I did that for 9 years. Here's what I learned from that experience and the signature I put on those years. I helped bring together public-private partnerships where civic leaders move together in the same direction on initiatives to help our community. During that time, and my husband is here, my husband and I have raised 6 children. We actually went through the Great Recession and firmly understand what it's like to feel economic insecurity and also to hope for the future of the next generation. I left the chamber. I trained as a certified mediator. I'm skilled in bringing people together to resolve disputes, both individuals, attorneys, organizations, and I use that skill when I went on the Board of Supervisors. I chaired our Board of Supervisors here in Albemarle County. That was my legislative experience, and I learned firsthand what that seat in Washington can do for all of us. And I have some specific projects I'd like to work on. I'm sure those will come out in the question and answer period. The thing I'd like to leave you with is there's another reason why I'm running besides actionable results, and that is I think we've sent the wrong people to Washington. We want to send people who want to do the business of our people, who want to get along. We can disagree on principled policy, but we also have to have principled compromise. And I have a record of doing that in this community, and I will do it for the 5th District. Anyway, I look forward to your questions, and I will have some closing comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Now we have an opening statement from Republican nominee Tom Garrett.
Thank you, Bob. I want to thank you and the other Bob, the immediate past president of the Senior Statesman, John Terry, Madison Rich, Margaret, and all exactly 200 people who are in this room, because the fire marshal says there can't be any more than that, so I know it's exactly 200. It's an incredible honor to be here in front of you today and standing next to Jane, who I hold in high regard. You know, this district, somebody asked me a while ago what it might be like to replace Robert Hurt. You know, he's done a good job, and these are big shoes to fill. And I said, well, you know, if you know your history, and I know Jane knows this, if you go back, the first Virginia representative to the House of Representatives from the 5th is a fellow named James Madison. So those are little tiny big shoes to fill. A little bit about myself. I grew up in Louisa County, attended Louisa County High School. I'm a big fan of Albemarle High School sports now. That's not true. played a little football, wrestled a little bit. Went to college and paid for that with an ROTC scholarship, then subsequently served as a fire supporter for just under 6 years and served abroad leading soldiers in harm's way in Operation Joint Guard and Joint Endeavor. Have seen soldiers leave having paid the ultimate sacrifice while wearing a uniform and understand what that means. So I served there. I served as a prosecutor in a county where there was a problem, certainly by virtue of the population and the crime rate that was out of whack with all other statistics, and cut the category one crime rate 50% in 1 year. I'm proud of that service. I'm proud of being able to give that back to my community. And served as a state senator for 5 years and garnered a lot of awards that were, you know, bipartisan awards. They weren't Republican awards or Democrat awards. In fact, our first year, the chamber named us the freshman of the year. There were 26 or 24 people in our freshman class between the House and Senate. Two were distinguished as the freshman of the year. We earned that reward, or award for getting things done. Earned the Champion of Criminal Justice Award. Earned the Champion of Regulatory Reform Award, rolling back regulations on things like who might be allowed to braid hair for a living or to drive a tow truck to support their family. Just recently, in fact, I think yesterday, earned the endorsement of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is pretty awesome. That's 1,497 independent businesses in the 5th Congressional District and many times that many employees, because we've worked with these folks and they know that we're willing to work across the aisle to get things done. And it's not just talk. When Dave Marsden carried bills in Virginia to ensure that children with intractable epileptic seizures could have access to cannabinoid A oils, medical marijuana, I spearheaded the Republican effort to make sure that these things were allowed. Right now, federally, cocaine is listed as a Schedule II controlled substance, meaning there are legitimate recognized medical uses. But marijuana is a Schedule I, saying there aren't any, right? I think Jane and I could agree that people in Washington sometimes are so afraid to do the right thing that they ignore problems when they try to cross the room and wave at them. Worked with Barbara Favola, Democrat of Arlington, to end the ridiculous, draconian, and cruel practice of seclusion and restraint of our children when they handcuff primarily little boys to chairs and converted janitor's closets. This happened in Virginia until 2 years ago when I worked across the aisle with Senator Favola to end that ridiculous practice.
Time.
I don't. Who has the cards? Okay. And I'll have a closing statement, too. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Bob. And hold that card up higher. I didn't see it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Now it's time for questions from the audience. I'm going to combine the first two questions together. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to respond, and we'll go with Senator Garrett first. Do you support legislation in Virginia to require congressional and state legislative districts to be drawn on clear, nonpartisan criteria? The second part of the question, Senator Garrett, in 2015, you voted for every anti-gerrymandering measure One Virginia 2021 supported. In 2016, you voted against every such measure. Please explain your change of position and tell us where you stand today on efforts to end gerrymandering in Virginia.
Well, I anticipated that question might arise at this debate, so I wanted to give you guys material for the question. No, ultimately, I'm a little hesitant as it relates to bipartisan redistricting because the difference between a thinker and a learner is asking that second question. The first question is almost always easily answered. Should we have universal access to health care? Absolutely, right? That's easy. Then the how and the who and the what becomes more difficult. Is bipartisan redistricting a good idea? Absolutely. Who appoints the bipartisans, right? All too many times in politics, and make no mistake about it, the appointment of bipartisan redistrictors, whether they were judges or whomever, would be affected by a political process. Things masquerade as bipartisan, and they're not. And I think folks on both sides of the aisle can see that and appreciate that reality. So I'm in favor of eliminating ridiculous gerrymandered districts, so long as we can do so in a manner that would be fair to both sides. I think, candidly, that the best solution, because I like to offer solutions instead of just offering platitudes, might be some sort of automated process that tries to group together communities of interest, wherein both sides Democrats and Republicans agree on what these definitions are, and then essentially to press a button and then agree on districts. But to have people appointed by a Republican governor and then call themselves bipartisan, or a Democrat governor and call themselves bipartisan, I think is unfortunately a little bit unrealistic.
Thank you. Tom Garrett. Jane Ditmar, same question.
When I was on the Board of Supervisors, we actually did pass a resolution in support of One Virginia 2021 and encouraged all of the legislators that represented parts of Albemarle to support it. I am hearing about this issue all over the 5th District. People are amazed that if they live in Northern Virginia, part of our district, that they are in the same district as those that live in Southside. They have very different priorities and needs, and we are expected to represent all of them. The number one problem with gerrymandering, of course, is people not being able to choose their politicians instead choosing them. But there's another problem, and that is it puts together regions that don't belong together. We have 10,000 square miles that either Tom or I are going to have to represent. I'm up for the job, but I'm really hopeful that One Virginia 2021 is successful in actually wresting this from control of the General Assembly and putting it in bipartisan hands after 2021.
Thank you, Jane Ditmar. The next question is for both candidates, and we'll start with Jane. Jane, the U.S. spends twice as much on health care per capita as many other developed countries. Yet life expectancy and other measures of good health are no better or even worse. About 10% of Americans have no health insurance. How would you improve things?
Well, I think we started down that road for improvement with the Affordable Care Act. Over 20 million new members of our country are insured. We still have gaps. Gaps are big here in Virginia, where we are not accepting Medicaid funds. I hear from those people that are in those gaps everywhere I go. I think that one of the things we need to do with the Affordable Care Act is look at where we are with it and improve it, and there are things we need to do with regard to that. I've been very frustrated, as many of you may be, with the current state in Congress where we have our Republicans trying to rip up the entire Affordable Care Act, our Democrats having to use all their energy to save it. There are so many things we can do to improve it, and that's what we need to get to work at.
I know it's a healthcare question. Could you repeat the question?
Yes. The U.S. spends twice as much on healthcare per capita as many other developed countries, yet life expectancy and other measures of good health are no better or even worse. About 10% of Americans still have no health insurance. How would you improve things?
Yeah, and so it's shameful, but it's demonstrative of the fact that throwing more money at a problem is not necessarily the solution. That we spend twice as much and don't have the quality of care as some other developed nations is shameful. What's happened, though, is we've stymied competitions. You cannot compete as it relates to a health care policy across state lines. We had limits on portability that were artificially imposed by the government. We have stifled programs like health savings accounts, which showed great promise, have only existed since 2003, sort of turned our backs as opposed to encouraging responsible investments into those accounts. You know, you pick up a number of people off the rolls of the uninsured, and yet you push other folks out of their plans. Things like Cadillac taxes on people's plans who've earned the opportunity to work in jobs where these policies are some of the incentive that brought them to work there discourage achievement, discourage people's individual initiative. If you like your doctor, if you like your plan, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your plan. We've seen that promise made and broken. And so I think what we need to do is look into alternatives. We need to open up the marketplace. We need to allow people to compete across state lines. A federal involvement that guarantees the portability of a plan is a good thing. Involvement that ensures that individuals are allowed to choose their own plan and make decisions for themselves is a good thing. But mandating upon one group of the population that they have to have coverage for potential problems that they biologically can't ever experience isn't a good thing. And so I think think, unfortunately, a lot of the problems that the federal government attempts to solve in healthcare are, in fact, created by the federal government. I think we need to step back, encourage health savings accounts, encourage alternative medicine, encourage individual initiative, and allow individuals to make their own decisions instead of penalizing them for not pushing, for not jumping into a one-size-fits-all plan.
Thank you. Tom Garrett. Next question is from a resident of Albemarle County who asks, why is the quest for public safety with regard to gun violence a discussion marked by fear of alienating groups on the left and the right? Groups on the right who misinterpret the Second Amendment and groups on the left who seem to believe there is no safety with gun ownership. Tom, we'll start with you and then go to Jane.
Yeah, ultimately, the question as it relates to the Second Amendment comes down to one of whether or not you believe the founders were correct in their assertion that a free republic and the citizens thereof have an individual right to keep and bear arms, as affirmed in the recent Supreme Court decision in Heller. I think it's shameful that so much of the rhetoric is directed in the manners and directions that it is. That so many particular types of guns or guns that look a certain way are vilified. When you step back, you know, and divorce yourself from the emotion of the issue, and you look at the raw numbers, you know, and you learn that long guns, for example, what some people would brand assault weapons, I think you're four times more likely to be killed with a knife. You're twice as likely to be killed by hands or feet, time and a half more likely to be bludgeoned than to be killed by these weapons. So ultimately, the problem, I don't think, is guns. The problem is violence. The murder rate, guns notwithstanding, in the United States outstrips that across the globe. And when we talk about, you know, individualized tragedies and things that have happened, they're all horrible. But let's look at the numbers in mass. So until we can crack down on knife murder and bludgeoning murder and hands and feet murder, I don't think vilifying an object, an inanimate object, is necessarily the solution. If you believe that the founders were right in their constitutional vision as it related to the Second Amendment.
First of all, to whomever wrote that question, it was really well thought out. What the question involves is two things, and I get asked this all over the district. What's your position on the Second Amendment, and what do you think about what's going on in the country at this time? Number one, I support our Constitution. As an elected official, I raised my hand. I took an oath to defend our Constitution. The Second Amendment is the Second Amendment of a Constitution I love. What's going on in the country now, though, is we've got potentially a problem for the Second Amendment. To protect the Second Amendment, we have to do something, and we need to do it in this next Congress. We need to have universal background checks. We need to make sure... We need to make sure that people who shouldn't own guns are not allowed to buy them. Now, there are a lot of guns out there. There is a gun for every person in America. So it's not that we're going to be going out and getting those guns, but in the future, we do not want to sell to people that have certain types of mental illness, a proclivity towards violence, particularly under protective orders, and anybody who we've identified as a terrorist. Now, we have a no-fly list that's identified a lot of terrorists, and people want to fight that list. What we need to do is fix the list to make sure there's a swift appeals process if someone who shouldn't be on that list gets on that list, but we need to use that list to protect us from terrorists buying those things. Now, the majority, vast majority of Americans want this, as do NRA members, and I'll work for this in Congress.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Our next question is also for both candidates, also with 90 seconds to respond. What is your stance on the Atlantic Coast fracking gas pipeline proposed in our district? I think I said that right. Jane, you're first.
That was a mouthful, wasn't it, Bob? What's going on with pipelines? There's not just the Atlantic Coast, by the way. We have some pipelines that want to go across the 5th District down in Franklin County and Pennsylvania County. The seat in Washington can do a couple things with regard to that, so I'll limit my thoughts with regard to actionable items. the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission did not do right by citizens in the Fifth when they held their hearings. It's important for them to honor and respect citizens where they live, and that needs to be looked at, and people need to be held accountable for that. Additionally, FERC, as they're referred to, is not required to look at all of these pipelines trying to crisscross our 5th District in their entirety. It's not that they're prohibited from doing that, but they're not required, and I would like to see that analyzed. So I'll work on those two things for those that are impacted by the pipeline when I get to Washington.
Thank you, Jane. Tom?
I don't know. I mean, we're supposed to actually give a position on the pipeline. So I'll tell you that I have been supportive of pipelines heretofore. There are north of 1,000 gas pipelines in North America right now, but I will not say that I support this pipeline. And the reason for that is the people who will be most impacted by the pipeline may choose not to have the pipeline. There's a Columbia gas pipeline that crosses the James River about a half mile up from where I call home right now that created the opportunity for, I think, $14 million in tax revenue to Fluvanna County. I think I see Mrs. Booker in the audience total in the last 15 years, plus a lot of high-paying jobs. I think they told me when I was at the plant the average salary out there is in the $70,000 ballpark. And there was a real fight over putting that power plant in, but the county now is reaping the benefits and has some beautiful infrastructure as a result of the revenue. Having said that and saying that historically I am pro-pipeline, I will not be for this pipeline if the citizens of the localities that will be impacted by it. And I want to be clear on this because I think it's good to actually give an answer to the question, do you support it or oppose it? If the citizens of the counties that will be impacted by the pipeline, who I represent, are opposed to the pipeline. I'm going to listen to the people, and if Nelson County is not interested in that pipeline, I know there's an alternate route, and there are people who'd like that pipeline. So historically have been pro-pipeline. I'll point out that there are well over 1,000 gas pipelines in this nation already, but I'm not necessarily pro this pipeline. I want to listen to the people of the district.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Next question for both candidates with up to 90 seconds to respond. And this has been asked several times. I'll ask it this way. What is your position on Donald Trump's criticism of the Khan family, the local Gold Star family whose son was killed protecting all of us? Tom, you're first, and then Jane.
To the extent that he criticized the family, that's not good. I think Donald Trump is a smart man who sometimes picks dumb words. Having wore the uniform, knowing soldiers who pay the ultimate sacrifice, having friends who've lost an arm specifically in one instance, I think that Humayun Khan is every bit as much or more of a hero than any one of those young men and women with whom I served. Having said that, you know, it strikes me that there's what might be described as disproportionate outrage as it relates to his opponent, who said, what difference at this point does it make how those four brave Americans died in Benghazi. I mean, I don't think that carried on for 5, 6, 7 days above the fold in the Washington Post. It strikes me, it's okay if you disagree with me, but if you let me talk, that'd be nice too. I think ultimately that he was inartful and that was unfortunate. I respect and honor the sacrifice of Humayun Khan. I knew men and served with men like him. Folks like him are the reason that we have the opportunity to be here at places like this and have forums like this. And, you know, Donald Trump needs to pick his words better.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Dittmar?
I'm on record saying that I think what Donald Trump said was reprehensible. It's more than tone. It's more than forgetting the best way to communicate. There is an attitude there, and he disrespected a Gold Star family. I don't have a military background, but I sure felt it when that happened. I was also appalled at what he did with the Purple Heart. You mentioned your friend that lost an arm. A Purple Heart really means something about sacrifice. I really am pleased at the Republicans that came out, those with military backgrounds and those that didn't, that called Trump out 100% on what he said.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Next question is for both candidates, up to 90 seconds in response. A Charlottesville resident asks, how willing are you to defy your party whip and vote the interests of your district rather than the interests of your party? Jane, you're first.
I've always said, to the extent that a group of people like thinking about policy, want to vote in a certain way that would help my district, well then, count me in. I did that when I was representing the magisterial district of Scottsville, and I will do that when I'm in Congress. I have been asked this question a couple of times. Let me tell you how I've answered it. At this age, for what I want to do on Capitol Hill for you and for me, I am not interested in any paths to power. What I'm interested in is working hard, doing a good job for the district, and coming home proud of the work I did.
Tom Garrett.
I was excited about stepping back from national politics for a few hours, but I guess we didn't. I want to say this. If anybody thinks that Jane's running against Donald Trump, I candidly wish she were. Most of my Democrat friends wish they'd had some more choices in who the nominee was. As it relates to defying leadership, I've kind of made a career out of it. If you Google search Tom Garrett and Virginia Capitol Press Corps, the Republican Senate leader threw the press corps off the Senate floor for the first time in modern history this year. Do you know who the only person to file a rule change to bring the press corps back on the floor was? He's standing in front of you here today. Because why? Because transparency and openness and a free fourth estate is key to getting what we need done as a people in our electorate. I stood up and fought for that, and I will stand up and fight for that sort of thing in Washington when our leadership is wrong. When there was a leadership fight within the party, I was the only person willing to come forward and stand up for a change in leadership. When I didn't think that the values of the people of the Commonwealth of Virginia were being represented adequately, I was the only person publicly, and I'm looking at the members of the press corps who were there who stood up and said, we need a change in leadership inside the Republican caucus. So I am not afraid of any human being. I am not afraid of anything other than being held account for my imperfections to my creator when God hits the off button. But going to Washington and fighting against a partisan-leaning interest when it's not in the interest of the people in the 5th District is not only something I will do, it is something I will relish. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Tom, you get the first response to the next question. What are your plans to rebuild our military and to fix the VA so that it takes care of our veterans?
Could you hold for 2 seconds? We've got a parking issue you'll need to read out.
We have a parking issue. Blocking field parking, VA VC74560, and Eddie Baker Ford Explorer, dark red, VA XKC4214. If you could move your cars, that way they will not be towed. Question again is plans to rebuild the military and to fix the VA.
Yeah, it strikes me when I was in the Army, we had all sorts of systems that were gee whiz, whiz bang, neato systems that we didn't need. And as I grew older, I started to understand that some of these systems were built and fielded because people in Congress decided that there were jobs coming to their district. But the soldiers and sailors and airmen and the Marines that defend this nation understand what their needs are. We shouldn't be pouring dollar after dollar into broken programs. We should be listening to the military leadership about what the needs of the military are, and those are the programs that we should be supporting and funding and fielding. As it relates to the VA, I believe that you keep the promises that you make to people, whether it is absolutely positively funding Social Security going forward, and we have a concrete plan for that that I'd invite you to our website to check out, or whether it is keeping promises to the women and men who wore the uniform of the United States in defense of our nation and Constitution. And it is shameful what's happened at the VA. I will tip a hat to the nurses and doctors of that institution because I hear nothing but good things from my veteran friends, but the administrators are broken. What I would like to see done is an overlay of VA facilities with existing hospital facilities. The cost of redundancy in healthcare drives prices through the roof. An MRI machine is not cheap. Two of them right next door to each other doesn't make sense. So the VA should be an apparatus to help veterans negotiate the maze of their healthcare needs, that falls in on top of world-class medical facilities like UVA, like Martha Jefferson, like MCV, and I guarantee you the civilian administrators in those programs will take good care of the veterans who come in for service in their centers. So we should streamline those facilities, and we should make sure that we walk our vets through the process with every bit of honor and dignity and care that they've earned by putting on a uniform that is tantamount to saying, I'm willing to give my life for something that's bigger than me. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Detmar.
So we had some common ground on the last question, and I think we have common ground here. Let me explain it, though, just a little bit differently. As I go throughout the district and veterans come to the meetings that I'm having, they talk about the fact that their health care, once they get it, is excellent. That was the tipping of the hat. It's getting the appointments, and it's the administration that we have to work on. Now, often the corporate sector does not overlay completely or properly on a public sector, but we have continuous improvement, quality improvement programs that are tried and true in the private sector that really need to get culturally down in the VA. So that's something we can work on. Also, veterans have been saying, especially in this rural district that we have, Charlottesville region and Danville are about it, the rest is rural, that they cannot access appointments or telemedicine, which is growing as a service, because they do not have internet. So that's something we are going to have to deploy in this district to help veterans. Finally, we need to listen to our military leaders. They've been telling Congress over and over again, don't appropriate that way. Don't make us pay for those things. We need to pay for these things. We have, as just an example, because we use our military often as a jobs bill, we have a fighter, the F-35, that's being built in 50 different states. That is waste. That is inefficiency. I think if we send people to Congress with business backgrounds who will listen to our military leaders, talk to our veterans, we can make changes in both how we fund the military and how we treat our veterans.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. It's time for another public service announcement. It appears people have been driving some very nice cars here today. One of them is a Subaru Outback XAJ3982. One is a Nissan Sentra WVJ6069. One is a Prius, of course, XED1427. And one is a Toyota Prius, again, HEB113. Sandwiched in and emergency vehicles are not able to pass. So if those four owners can check on those four cars to avoid tows. Jane Dittmar, you get the first response to the next question. Environmental legislation has been stalled at the national level. For example, the Clean Water Act was last authorized in 1987. What is your position on the EPA and the environment?
Thank you. Just what you said is a great example of what is not working in Congress. Congress has passed aspirational goals and then turns over the writing of regulations and the enforcement to the executive branch. We need to tighten down, drill down on the role of legislators. They are supposed to write legislation and they are supposed to stay current, right? Anyway, as far as the EPA, there's a lot of talk about blowing up the EPA. So why don't I answer this? I'm not for blowing up the EPA. We want clean water. We want clean air. We want to be able to pass a planet on to our children and their children and on that we haven't abused and used and acted like it's a going out of business sale. So to the extent that I'm 100% behind aspirational goals, I think we have some work to do on reauthorizations and tightening up our legislation so that it's current. Thank you.
It's amazing because I think Jane's spot on. Ultimately, if you look at Article 1 of the Constitution, the responsibility for legislation lies with Congress, right? And what we have is a Congress that won't make agreements on things that are important. And so what's happened by default is the president said, well, I have a phone and a pen. These are things I can get done. And so what we have then is rulemaking wherein people can lose property, people can lose their freedom, people can lose money that they've earned by virtue of a regulatory body of the executive branch, which is tantamount to law, as Jane would know, as a mediator. And so we have the abdication of responsibility from Congress to the executive branch. That needs to end. having, and I'll tell you this, the environment's about stewardship. I grew up with six-generation English setters. We hunted quail. And when there were so few quail that we could no longer hunt them because of clean farming and pesticides, we paid the farmer who leased our land less or more money to leave the land not plowed, create more hedgerows. I went out by hand and cultivated bicolor lespedeaser, and we grew and we cultivated quail that we never hunted because we cared about having them. Stewardship is where this, what this comes down to ultimately, and it strikes me as a little odd when the EPA is responsible for piercing a containment facility out west that, that polluted literally hundreds and hundreds of miles of riverbed, and nobody's held accountable, right? The entity tasked with protecting our environment has created one of the greatest environmental catastrophes of the last 2 years, destroying miles and miles of riverline in the western United States, and not a single head rolled. Think about that for a moment. So ultimately, Congress needs to legislate, and they need to engage themselves in the important business of the people. We need to wrest that activity from the executive administrative branch, because candidly, you deserve the right as voters to rehire or fire your representatives. It shouldn't be someone who you've never heard of, never voted for, and who will never be fired in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Next question is for both candidates, and we'll start with Tom Garrett. What is your goal for leadership in the area of improving race relations?
It's so awesome having had the opportunity to serve the United States military. And I see a number of people nodding their heads. The neat thing, and I think the unique qualification that anybody who's served has, is you're thrust into a unit. Okay. In that unit are people from anywhere in the nation. The socioeconomic differences between the individuals is vast. The racial experiences of the individuals is vast. The life experiences of the individuals is vast. And yet you're told this is your mission, accomplish your mission, and do it within these sets of parameters. Right? The best way to heal racial relations in the United States of America is to ensure that people of all creeds and colors and backgrounds learn that they can work together on a single goal, a single mission, and accomplish that mission one hand in hand with the other, regardless of what they look like, who they worship, or where they're from. And there ain't no better place to learn that than the United States military. So, this isn't an argument in favor of universal conscription, but... But that might make the news. I just think, you know, the best place to heal race relations in the 5th District is in the cafeterias of our public schools, in the aisles of our churches, in the Food Lion parking lot. When you're walking out of a restaurant, if you can hold the door for somebody and treat everybody just like you'd want to be treated if the roles were reversed, we will see things change for the better. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Dittmar.
I wish it were as easy as that. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot roiling under the surface that we haven't been paying attention to. And so we need to look at the facts, and we need to identify some problems, and we have to own up to them, and we have to do something about them. When I realized, and I'm embarrassed to say, it took me a long time as an adult to pay attention to this, about the vast difference in incarceration rates between whites and African Americans, I was appalled. When I realized how many African Americans were in our prisons, there are actually too many Americans in our prisons, there is a sense of injustice that can only be cured by working on those problems and making sure that we don't revisit them. I didn't understand about voter suppression and the kinds of rules that we have in place that keep people from the polls. I have heard about the pain and anguish in African American communities and now somewhat in our Latino communities with the way they feel treated. I wish it were as easy, and I would love for all of us to do what Tom said, be nice to your neighbor, the golden rule. But we have some infrastructure problems, some systemic infrastructure problems that need addressing, and only then can we hope for more peace and less racial tension.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Jane, you get the first crack at the next question. What specific project do you most want to take forward and work on? What is the most important project you intend to take to Washington if elected? Jane.
All right, so I only have 90 seconds. When I'm in this area and people talk to me about my number one issue that I want to accomplish, they say, why is this deployment of internet and accessible and good cell service so important? And they ask that question because they have internet. If you look at our 10,000 square miles, this district that is larger than the state of New Jersey, we are worse than a third world country in terms of connectivity. It is holding back our rural families. It's holding back our rural economies. Our children can't do their homework at home. I mentioned that veterans can't access service. You don't know what's going on in government, local, state, or federal, if you can't access the internet. We have small businesses that can't grow. Agribusiness is being left behind. I know actually how we can help state and local government with funds from the Federal Communication Commission that are already allocated, that other congressmen are going out and grabbing up for their communities, and I will bring that back to the fifth. There's a lot of other things I want to work on, but I'm like a dog after a bone on that one.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Tom Garrett.
So it's interesting when you learn the fifth district to understand what an economic engine the fifth district was for Virginia for so long. And it's not what it used to be. Tens of thousands of jobs in textiles and furniture have been driven from Pennsylvania County and Danville, from Henry County and Mecklenburg. And they've been driven out largely because of a regulatory climate and a tax climate that absolutely doesn't recognize the needs of those employers and the employees. Economic opportunity is really the paramount issue in this fight. And understanding when economic opportunity presents itself and taking advantage of that is how you solve that problem. Let me give you a couple of examples. The Schutz Brewery wanted to come to Albemarle County and bring 150 jobs there, plus or minus. And there was a zoning application to bring those jobs, and I don't know, over $85 million in investment to the county. The county board of supervisors wouldn't let them do it. And later, Ballast Point Brewery, so Deschutes went to Roanoke. And later, Ballast Point Brewery said they'd like to have come to Albemarle County, but they watched what happened with Deschutes, and they took their 148 jobs and $50 million of investment to Roanoke, in, I believe, the 6th Congressional District. So you have to understand what business needs to succeed. You have to honor individual initiative and work. And you have to create a climate in which businesses can succeed and job growth can occur, which is exactly what didn't happen with Ballast Point and Deschutes when they tried to come bring these good jobs that would have allowed people to put their kids through college to Albemarle County. The issue in the 5th District that will overarch all others is economic opportunity and how to make the south side of Virginia and central Virginia thriving economic leaders in the Commonwealth again. I understand it. That's why the National Federation of Independent Businesses just gave us their endorsement. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Tom Garrett, you're first up for the next question, I believe. If studies show that industrial hemp would be a valuable crop for farmers in the region, is there any way you could support allowing the growing of industrial hemp as a biofuel and source of quality paper and clothing?
Well, I already have. There was an industrial hemp bill before the General Assembly a couple of years ago. I don't understand why we see a growth industry like hemp. Virginia is situated geographically in a region that would make us essentially one of the best areas to grow hemp in the world. It's an organic product that replenishes the soil when, if we were to rotate crops, and it would provide economic opportunity in agrarian societies and rural agricultural areas like the south side of this district where it's leaving in the form of tobacco. So because hemp is first cousin to marijuana, we should turn our backs on those jobs? I think that sort of draconian thinking is outmoded, outdated, and I think that, that this millennial generation, if not our generation and your generation and everyone's generation that wants to see growth and opportunity, will set aside a molecular difference of a scintilla to in favor of opportunity. So, yeah, I would absolutely support that. I don't know why we aren't there yet. We need to get there. And so not only would I support it, I would lead the charge, I think, on ensuring that that greater economic opportunity presented itself to the farmers, the lifeblood of the 5th District of Virginia.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Dittmar.
Yes, I absolutely support it. I've talked to farmers south of us all the way to Southside, those especially involved in tobacco farming. It would be an ideal crop for their almost fallow land now. I would like to mention that when we were looking at how we could grow agribusiness, you cannot bring companies to an area that does not have internet. It's an infrastructure that is essential. And so you can look at all the different ways to attract business, and if you don't have it, they're not coming. And businesses and that hire consultants to find new places to go will tell you that. I would like to mention about the breweries. We are doing very well in the Central Virginia area. Our unemployment rate is below what we call full employment. We do have an underemployment problem in that people need even better jobs, especially middle class jobs. And I think that the what we want to do is to work on appropriate places for them to be. The reason why Deschutes and other good employers are not coming to Albemarle County is because we have a paucity of land that is already zoned properly for them. We were lucky, and I worked with the governor on this, that we kept Deschutes in Virginia. We were actually competing with North Carolina, and I am sick of losing jobs to North Carolina. So anyway, yes to hemp. We shouldn't look at that as a marijuana issue, but unfortunately it's gotten a little confused, and I think we will see it as a legal product in the future here in Virginia.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. You have first crack at the next question, which is, will you work to bring the Voting Rights Act of 1965 back on the table to address the preclearance section of that act that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled invalid?
I think if I'm understanding the question, what we're talking about is some of the weakening of the 1965 Act. What we were hopeful for is that our states would behave themselves and that we would relax these requirements on them. What we have found is that's not the case, and so we now have litigation. One, I think, just went before the Supreme Court. So, yes, I would like to tighten back up on those regulations and make sure that there's teeth in enforcing them.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Tom Garrett?
So I don't know. I drive 20 south from Charlottesville to Scottsville all the time, and I can't get a cell signal. So I don't know who was responsible for putting cell towers in on 20 south or 29 coming out of the city. But by golly, it might be nice to get private sector cell service before we start talking about government internet service. Maybe Albemarle's board supervisor could speak to that. I was actually at the governor's mansion the night the Deschutes people came and visited. Flan and I were there and met with them with Governor McAuliffe. It was an interesting meeting, and I'm glad, too, that they came to Virginia and didn't go to North Carolina. And as it relates to the Voting Rights Act, we need clarification from the federal courts what exactly is valid and is not valid in the Voting Rights Act right now, because Virginia was out of compliance with the ruling on the Voting Rights Act because it was in compliance with the prior ruling on the Voting Rights Act. So as with so many issues, the federal government's presented a moving target for the states to try to hit. So you had a third congressional district in Virginia that literally ran down the middle of the James River where no one lived, and I think two different places, to comply with the Voting Rights Act, which was later ruled illegal because the courts changed how they interpreted the Voting Rights Act. So what we need is a federal government that is brave enough to tell us what the right thing to do is and then stand by it without changing it midstream while the states work to comply. So many of the problems that we see, and a large part of the reason I'm running in Virginia, are driven by people in Washington who are afraid to tell us when up is up and down is down and what's right and what's wrong. We need clarity from the federal government on the Voting Rights Act, and then we need to ensure that everyone has the right to vote fairly and freely.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. You're up first on the next question. Do you acknowledge that the burning of fossil fuels causes climate change?
I absolutely, positively believe that climate change is real. I believe that as long as there's been a climate, it's been changing. The question then... The question then becomes, and certainly it will continue. The question then becomes one of whether it's man-caused climate change. If the indications are that the climate change that we experience is man-caused, then we need to look at what we can do to put those into check, and we need to do a cost-benefit analysis of the amount of change that can be made by actions that we can take. in order to bring these things under control. However, we know there's climate change. There is debate as to whether it's man-caused climate change, and there's real debate, and there's...
Let's let the candidate respond, please.
There is debate over whether it's man-caused climate change, and so the question then becomes one of cost-benefit analysis and what we can do to temper that climate change. If the United States acts unilaterally, then we will lose a significant deal more than others with what is to be gained to be debated down the road. So what we need to do is take a long, hard look at both sides of the science, determine what amount of the climate change is man-caused, determine what amount of the climate change is man-caused, and then act appropriately after doing a cost-benefit analysis of what we give up and what we gain by that action.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Same question for Jane Dittmar. Do you acknowledge that the burning of fossil fuel causes climate change?
Well, first of all, climate change is a reality. We do agree on that. There are factors that are causing climate change that may not be man-made, but there are a whole lot that are. Fossil fuel emissions are warming up our atmosphere, and I worked with local governments all over Virginia that are dealing with adaptation strategies now. We need to go at this two ways. One, how do we adapt? We must adapt. The other is, how do we mitigate or slow it down? And that will require us taking a long, hard look at our relationship with fossil fuels. Now, we can't just say we're not going to use fossil fuels. Our economy depends on energy, as do we in our homes. But we need to move gracefully into natural gas and really stimulate our renewable, clean energy sector in the future.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Jane, you get the first crack at the next question. With looming debt and entitlement obligations, what policies will you bring forward to address the future of our grandchildren?
I sometimes am asked, what do I think is the greatest threat to my children's future? And if it's not climate change, it is the national debt. And we need to take that very seriously. With almost $20 trillion in debt, if we don't get after that soon, we are going to have a real problem here in the United States, where interest eats away all the different things that we need the federal government to be involved in. Number one, I really reject the idea that we should be talking about let's do a tax increase or a tax decrease. We need to take our tax code and put everything on the table and only through good negotiation decide what to put back in. We have such a chaotic tax code that we don't know what we're earning and what we're not earning, and that needs to change. Additionally, we need to look at our priorities, decide what percentages of our budget should be funded that way, and then we need to see where our cuts can go. I am very disturbed with any Virginia elected official that would vote to shut down our government or even for sequestration. This Commonwealth is impacted the worst of the entire country when we do budgeting that way. So we need to do hard work, roll up our sleeves, not take recesses, and get to work on that sort of thing.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Tom Garrett, same question.
So, again, I want to give you answers and not platitudes. It's easy to talk about hard work and good negotiation and looking at priorities and seeing where cuts could go, but specificity really is what people deserve. And so we have a president who said that $7 trillion in national debt was unpatriotic, and 7.5 years later we are closing on $20 trillion, which I can only do basic math, but that'd be about unpatriotic times three. So how do we solve problems? What are specific things we can do to maintain and keep the promises that we made to posterity, to everyone in this room? My mom is dependent upon Social Security. And Social Security's viability is up for debate. And so what we have proposed in this campaign is a program that would ensure that everyone who has earned the right to a Social Security check would have nothing to worry about for perpetuity, and that would alleviate student loan crises and debts that have been incurred by this current generation. Young people put off getting married. They put off buying cars. They put off buying homes. So how can you do it? What are your specifics? You allow young people who come out of college with student loan debt the opportunity to defer receipt of Social Security benefits. In return, they receive student loan forgiveness. If you did this for up to 10 years, it wouldn't change a single promise made to any senior citizen currently receiving Social Security, and it wouldn't change the promise to any of these students. What would it allow them to do is to get out from underneath the bubble of debt that stops them from buying a home, that crushes our real estate market, that stops them from buying a car, that stops them from getting married, and makes it unaffordable for them to live in outstanding communities like those here in Central Virginia. So specific solutions that allow people to make choices don't change the promises made to anyone, and allow us to then have the money to allow the promise of Social Security to be kept for perpetuity and not platitudes and blanket statements. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Tom Garrett, you were combining two questions for the next responses, and you answer first. Why did you help Dominion Power escape public oversight in rate setting for the next 10 years, and will you continue to take money from Dominion like you have in the past?
Dominion Power was subject to a draconian scheme of federal regulation as it related to emissions that took the power profiles of our states and did not take into consideration how responsible or clean the power generation in those states was. So, for example, in Virginia, 36% of all power generated is clean in the form of nuclear generated at Surya North Anna. Whereas in West Virginia, the vast bulk of the power generation that they had was coal-based. And so what the federal government said was, cut your emissions by half. Well, with the exception of states in the Pacific Northwest, like Washington, who use a massive amount of hydroelectric power, Virginia, relative to its peers, was doing a wonderful job. But the federal rulemaking, that is, laws promulgated by those not elected to create laws, put them in a situation where they had to find a way to survive and continue to produce, relative to our neighbors, a largely clean fuel portfolio. And so giving them a little bit of latitude along those lines did exactly that. And I would suggest that if you look at the folks who voted in favor of doing this, that you'll see a bipartisan swath of the General Assembly, just like those with whom I worked on things like K-12 ed reform, because it made sense for the ratepayers and the power producers, and it didn't make sense to punish Dominion for producing more clean energy than states like West Virginia and other neighboring states did to begin with by imposing draconian numbers games that didn't recognize the good work they're already doing.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Ditmar, same question, except we'll make it your position on Dominion's public oversight and your position on taking Dominion contributions.
Thank you. Who prevents the State Corporation Commission from looking at rate requests from Dominion Power? Dominion Power can make the same case each time they appear before the State Corporation Commission about the kinds of investment they're making, but to have no oversight, to give that up by legislative votes, means that they can go wild with our rates. There are a lot of people angry about this one. I hear about this one. I'm not going to pounce on Dominion Power. They are an important power partner. They just built or opened an incredible power plant in Mecklenburg County, which is great for their economy. But I decided that I would tell them that I would not accept campaign funds from them because they are known or are believed to influence our political process in a very in a way that's improper. And I didn't want there to be any doubt that when I'm working on pipelines and other legislation having to do with energy, that I was influenced in any way by campaign contributions.
Thank you, Jane Ditmar. Jane, you answer the next question first. What should the federal government be doing to combat sea level rise?
I wish I knew the answer to that one. It may come as a surprise to some of you that the Department of Defense has identified this as one of the key areas of concern for national security. I met with military people up in Warrenton, and they laid out for me what's going on at Langley Air Force Base, where at high tide we have waves lapping over runways, where they're having to reorient everything down at naval bases. Now, move it out of the military area and talk to my friends on the Board of Supervisors in Matthews County, where they can't get building permits anymore. They cannot get insurance for their homes. They're having to build new things up on stilts. So the rising sea level is a given. What can we do about it is something that I would need to have to research further if there are good answers out there.
Thank you, Jane Denmark. Tom Garrett, same question. What to do to combat sea level rise?
So I want to bounce back to the last question for a second and say that when Lake Monticello residents were being gouged by Aqua Virginia, when there was a real instance of people having their utility bills in the form of the water at Lake Monticello in Fluvanna County go up 20, 30, 40% in a year, there was one member of the Virginia Senate who carried a bill to increase transparency and to allow the people who were being gouged by that utility company some redress, and that was me. Thank you. One thing that we need to make sure we do as it relates to the question is retain the naval facilities at the Port of Norfolk. Right now, having lost Randy Forbes as a member of the Virginia Congressional Delegation, who was a senior member of the Armed Services Committee, and having lost some other senior members of the Virginia delegation, there's a movement afoot to move our carrier bases to Texas or Georgia or, at worst, Florida, right? So if you believe that rising sea levels are a concern, the Port of Norfolk is and should remain the largest naval base on the face of the planet. It's good for Virginia and tangentially good for the 5th District, and we're not anywhere near the level of threat, if you believe the data on sea level rise, that a place like Florida would be. So let's hold the status quo, keep those jobs here, and retain Virginia's power over that important part of our national defense. It's really as simple as watching what happens in the world and then understanding the Constitution and the separation of powers and understanding the tiers of government to know what level of government is responsible for what action on what problem. And I would submit to the extent that this is a problem, it would be a federal problem.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Tom, you get the next first question response. Do you believe in honoring the U.S. commitment to our NATO allies as stated in the North Atlantic Treaty?
I believe in keeping promises. And so if the North Atlantic Treaty needs to be relooked, we need to relook it. But until you tell someone that you're not going to do what you already told them you were going to do, that it's an incumbent upon a leader, and whether we like it or not, we are leaders, not in NATO, but in the world, to keep your word. And there is order and stability in the world by virtue of an America who is credible when they say that they will do something, when a red line is drawn, that red line is kept, and that promises made are promises kept. So whether it's NATO, or our promise to our seniors in the form of Social Security, or our promise to our citizens in the form of encouraging good job growth when the opportunities present themselves, I believe in doing what you say you're going to do. My father told me early on, when we talked about politics and how you do it and what's right, he said, "Son, I really genuinely believe," and this has been my experience as I like to jokingly brag about being the most predictable guy in the legislature, "that if you look people in the eyes and you tell them what you're going to do, and then you go do the very best you can to do it, that you'll be successful, so long as what you're doing is right for the people." And candidly, I think Jane's the same person. So I believe in keeping promises that we make, whether it's abroad or at home or in our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Denmark, same question, NATO.
Tom is right. We agree completely on that. We will and must keep our promises with regard to NATO and other agreements that are in place. At our military panel recently, what was said about that, since there was some national rhetoric about moving away from our NATO friends, was what we do is we put fear in the hearts of our friends abroad, and we tempt our enemies when we break our words. So, yes, we will stay true to our agreements with NATO.
Thank you, Jane DeMar. You're up first on the next question. For both of you, a recent report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation found that Medicaid expansion actually saves states money. Do you support Medicaid expansion? Why or why not?
I absolutely do. I'm not going to the General Assembly, so I can't help us here in Virginia except to make sure that the money is still there for us if we ever decide to take it or our Republicans allow us to take it. I will tell you that there is a real concern about rural health. Without this expansion, and you talk to anybody in a hospital administration and our doctors, we are teetering on having more hospitals close, and rural health service delivery will be compromised, jeopardized, or non-existent. So we must do something about this. I do support Medicaid expansion here in Virginia.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Tom Garrett.
This is the prototypical question to differentiate between learners and thinkers. Learners can go ABC and 1, 2, 3, and thinkers say why, what next? Because Medicaid 30 years ago was about 5 or 6% of the state's budget. The last time that we did a biennial budget, it was about 25 or 26% of the state's budget. So now we have something that's growing, that's doubling in size year after year and redoubling. And we talk about federal money for Medicaid expansion as if it's special money that comes from a different pool. The pool that federal money comes from are the pockets of everyone in this room and their children and their grandchildren. Ultimately, Medicaid expansion would expand a program that's already expanding exponentially. Say that 3 times fast. And so ultimately, then we have to ask ourselves, when in history has the federal government pushed money down to the states and said, don't worry, we're going to pick up this percentage of the tab on that, that ultimately down the road, when there was a budget crisis, they haven't pulled back and said, now it's on you. Now it's on you. So Medicaid expansion is absolutely, positively penny-wise. But I would submit that if history is any indicator, it is pound foolish. And Medicaid is a system where in one calendar year, there was over $1 billion in fraud recovered in Virginia alone. The biennial budget, that is, in 1 year, we spend about $47, $48 billion a year. That means 2% of the entire annual budget was recovered in fraud from one program in 1 year. So Medicaid expansion is like taking people off the sinking ship and throwing them into the sinking lifeboat. And it's sure short-term wise, but long-term foolish.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Now we're going to ask a question of each candidate individually. That candidate will have 90 seconds to respond, and his or her opponent will have 30 seconds to respond to the response. Tom Garrett first. Why don't you put your political party on your literature, your brochures?
I think I looked at our website yesterday, and it said Tom Garrett, constitutionally conservative Republican for Congress. I mean, so... Oh, I'm sorry. Did we miss a piece of literature? Listen, if you guys, I'm wide open to suggestions. Success has 1,000 fathers. Failure is an orphan. But I'm a Republican. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump in November, and we're going to win this election.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Response, Jane Dittmar.
I have that information on my literature, and there's fewer and fewer Republicans that are selecting your standard bearer there.
Jane Dittmar, this question goes first to you for 90 seconds with a 30-second response from Tom Garrett if he needs one. Jane, how are you going to fulfill your internet plan without raising taxes?
Great question, whoever asked it. There's misunderstanding about this plan, and so I better explain it, and I appreciate the opportunity. Every single one of you that has a landline still has a cell phone or both, sends fees to the federal government at the Federal Communications Commission, and they go into 4 funds. One of them is a Connect America fund, and I would like to bring some of those funds to the 5th District. It's going everywhere else. In fact, I was in a gathering at someone's home here in Albemarle County, and I was talking about South Dakota and how wired they are. I made a quip about there were more cattle there than people. Why do they have better internet and cell service than we do? A guy comes up to me afterwards and he says, I need you to know I'm from South Dakota. And I said, okay, well, hopefully you didn't take that as an offense. And he said, no, I'll tell you how we did it. The local government worked with the state government, with the Congress, and we got those grants and we pulled it down to South Dakota. It's their job in Washington to help us find those grants. So it's going to go somewhere, just like Medicaid, by the way. Tom said, it's in your pockets and it's going somewhere else. Why not keep it for us? We have to have a balanced budget here in the state. We'll deal with it if it ever comes to pass, this black cloud where the federal government takes Medicaid away. Back to the internet. There are other funds there to bring down for our libraries and our schools, and it's not tax dollars. It's your money that's parked in funds that's going every other place than the 5th District.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Tom Garrett.
It just strikes me as brazen to suggest that, we can have government-funded internet when I can drive through the Scottsville district down 20 to my home in Buckingham County and not have cell service half the way there. The first thing that needs to happen is boards of supervisors need to approve cell towers going into areas like 20 South coming out of Charlotte. How come I don't have cell service through North Garden? As soon as I hit Nelson County, I get it again. So ultimately, it does take the collaboration of local and state and federal officials, and we need to recognize that most of the internet that we're talking about here is driven off the very cell towers that people on boards of supervisors vote against allowing, right? So let's solve one problem at a time. The other thing that strikes me as funny is, can we stop trying to pour more money into a program that throws down $1 billion a year in fraud before we solve the fraud problem? Would that make sense? I mean, the expression pouring bad money after good seems appropriate here.
There are broad questions and there are specific questions. This falls under the category of a broad question. Tom, I believe you get the first crack at the answer, 90 seconds each. Please describe some solutions you propose for our country's problems. In 90 seconds.
So what makes America great is its people, and what makes America's people up are ideas, and ideas aren't always in agreement with one another. But when we create a climate in which individuals can take initiative and see the fruits of their labor come to fruition and then keep some of the fruits of their labor to expand that idea, then we get jobs and prosperity and growth. And so that's something that we need to move back towards. We cannot have a government in the business of picking winners and losers, because surely we will disagree over who the winners and losers should be. So we need to base this nation and its greatness on not its government, but its people. And then we need to have creative outside, thank you. We need to have creative outside the box thinking on how we keep the promises that we've made to society. How do we ensure that my mother never needs to worry about whether or not she'll receive her Social Security check? Well, one way to do that is by also alleviating some of the student loan crisis, but allowing individuals, right, to make choices for themselves about when they want to receive that benefit. And so we propose specific examples. Another thing is to recognize that sometimes it's tough to do the right thing and change laws that are on the books that aren't being enforced. Things like hemp and medical marijuana and children with intractable epilepsy and glaucoma, areas where we know that there is a legitimate use. Change the laws to recognize and reflect reality. We need a political class that's not so concerned with when people boo them or jeer them or heckle them that they won't do the right thing even when the right thing is hard. And that's how we solve America's problems.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Ditmar.
You know, at first when I heard that question, I went, whoa. But actually, it's a great question, and I have two answers for that. Number one, as a country, what we need to do is send different people to Washington. We need to send people who want to do the people's business and know how to work with each other to get it done. I'll save some of that remark for my closing comments. The other thing is we have an income inequality problem in this country. We need to make sure that Americans are well-trained, that the infrastructure is there for job expansion, and that people have an opportunity to get those jobs. And so I think that working on an economic platform, which was why I ran for the Board of Supervisors and partly why I'm running for Congress, is something that we all need to work together on and move forward on, because the income disparity is going to continue to cause even greater problems in this country. So, focus on economic development and job creation, and also send different people to sit in the seats to do the people's business.
Thank you, Jane Ditmar. Jane, you get the first crack at the next question, which is also rather general, but a little more specific. Would you commit to holding regular public town hall meetings across the 5th Congressional District?
Absolutely. I've enjoyed them so much when I was a supervisor, and people are thirsty for them around the district. What I like to do when I'm going into gatherings, whether it's a senior center or someone's living room or a church fellowship hall, is I like to talk a little bit about my background, the reason why I'm running, and then I open it up. And sometimes people start talking to each other and forget I'm even there. So town halls need to happen, and that's really where democracy percolates. So, yes.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Tom Garrett, townhouse?
Absolutely.
Very good. You get the last question, first answer, before we go into closing statements. The question is, considering that women make 78 cents for every dollar a man makes, and that 40% of families have a female breadwinner, do you support equal pay for equal work? Why or why not?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're doing the exact same job, if two construction workers work 9 hours on the same construction site all day long on the same machinery, they should be paid the same thing. Unless one's better than the other, in which case they should be paid more based on merit. If two teachers teach the same classroom, the same grade, in the same school, the same job for the same hours, by gosh, they should be paid the same thing. This is a no-brainer. And so we should compare apples and apples, and where we see people doing the same jobs, then they should be earning the same pay. And if they're not, then the employer should be able to justify to somebody why they're not, because that's absolutely unacceptable in the American system. Right? So let's compare equal work to equal work and then demand that there be equal pay for equal work when people are doing the same jobs.
Thank you, Tom Garrett. Jane Dittmar.
You won't be surprised that I'm absolutely for that 100%. There are some things also we need to do to make sure there's equal pay for equal work. And I'm talking primarily about the single mother who needs to have support with regard to childcare, transportation, and workforce training. So there's some things we can work on to make sure that that becomes a reality and not just a dream.
Thank you. And now it's time for the candidates' closing remarks, 3 minutes each. And going first is Tom Garrett.
You know, the good thing about not finishing your opening remarks is you don't have to worry that much about what you're going to say during your closing remarks. I think we were talking about some of the stuff that we'd done reaching across the aisle in Richmond. And I'll tell you that when I ran for the General Assembly 5 years ago, I didn't envision myself being captivated and motivated to reform our K-12 arena. But by gosh, the issue found me. And so I believe 2 or 3 years ago, there were 3 bills, one which reduced the SOL burden on our students, one which eliminated the draconian 140-seat-hour requirement that said in these subjects, students will sit in the seat for 140 hours without regard to whether they'd achieve mastery at 70 hours or whether they needed 145. It just said 140 hours. And one that allowed for expedited retakes for near misses on SOLs so that largely rural and sometimes urban communities weren't penalized as it related to the state assessment of performance of the teachers and the students. And I was either the chief patron or the co-patron of every single one of those bills. And I know to a metaphysical certainty that children in Virginia's public schools are better off right now than they were because we reached across the aisle and led on those issues. And there are some differences, again, about recognizing opportunity. The difference between success and failure so often in life, whether in the case of an individual or a community or a state or a Senate district or a county, is recognizing opportunity. So I'll talk about Hardywood Brewery, which is building a multi-million dollar facility in Gunnison County in my Senate district. And I'll talk about working with Governor Terry McAuliffe to ensure that those 100-plus jobs and tens of millions of dollars located in Gunnison County in the 22nd Senate district. And I'll counterbalance that with Ballast Point and Deschutes, who decided to move to Roanoke. It is important when opportunity comes along to grab that opportunity and to ensure that it's available for the people in the community who you purport to serve. And to understand that in the role of supervisor or senator or congressman, we are not served by the people. We serve the people, and to listen to the people and understand one thing, and that is that we know we don't know everything. Sometimes it's important to listen. And when you do that, then whether you're working with Terry McAuliffe or Tommy Norman, you can bring jobs to Goochlin County in the 22nd District or Albemarle County in the 5th. It's all about understanding what's right, making a commitment, looking people in the eyes, and working hard. And as Americans, by gosh, we can get this done. Thank you immensely for the opportunity. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Senior Statesman. Thank you, Jane. It's been awesome. I look forward to seeing you again as we move forward. God bless you all, and God bless America.
Thank you, Tom Garrett.
I, too, would like to thank the Senior Center, and Bob, you've done a masterful job facilitating us today, moderating us, the timers. Thank you. And all of you, thank you for coming out. This is the way we get information out about ourselves. I'm going to leave you with just one thing. I don't want to talk about policy in my closing. What I want to do is tell you a story. And this is the way the story goes. I have been fortunate enough to serve a number of governors on councils and commissions and committees, both Republican and Democrat. My first governor where I received an appointment was Jerry Beliles. He's actually retired to this area. I happened to have a really interesting conversation with him a couple of years ago. We were just dismayed at the dysfunction in Washington, the partisanship, the actual hatred among people that are supposed to be serving all of us here in the United States. And it was creeping over to Richmond. And I said, what is causing this? You have a long runway. What do you think is happening here? And what he said was this. He said, you know what? Politics have become a blood sport. We used to fight on policy. We used to have principled arguments. He said, but now it's about killing. It's about annihilating. And he said, we send these warriors to do the public's business, and they don't know how to govern. They do not know how to work with each other. And so I am so committed to the 5th District setting an example of the kind of person that should be up in Washington working for us and working hard. So I'm going to close by asking you to vote for me on November 8th. And if you've been at all moved by anything that you've seen or heard from me today, and you'd like to be more involved, we'd love to have you involved with the campaign. Thank you again very much for coming. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Thank you. Thank you, Jane Dittmar. Thank you, Tom Garrett. On behalf of our panel and sponsors, Senior Statesmen of Virginia and the Senior Center, I want to thank you all for coming out. 90 days to Election Day. Don't forget to vote on November 8th.